Dr. Rachel Griffin, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Utah, says she's spoken occasionally with men who come to realize that they may have actually raped someone.
Generally speaking, I think most people who hurt people, if they knew they could make a different choice, they might make a different choice. But I don't think that a lot of men, those socialized into manhood, whether it's trans men, genderqueer men, cis men, I don't think that most realize that the behavior they've learned is violent until they've already done the damage.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a conversation that addresses the normalization of rape, an examination of how this normalization of sexual violence is manifested and what actions can be taken to disrupt it. That conversation is coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're bringing you a conversation recorded recently that addresses the normalization of rape. Because sexual violence and rape happens so often and is punished so rarely, a growing number of scholars and activists say American society has become desensitized to it, operating under an assumption that rape is an inevitable fact of life. According to scholars, this normalization of rape, a problem recently highlighted on Utah's college campuses here specifically, has led some people to internalize beliefs and attitudes that condone and even encourage gendered sexual aggression and violence. On March 6th last month, a group of scholars at the University of Utah convened to examine these issues in a forum titled Rape is Not Normal, presented by the Office of Equity and Diversity. The conversation was moderated by Flor Olivo, a program coordinator with the Women's Resource Center.
Hi, everyone. I'm Flor. I'm the program coordinator over at the Women's Resource Center. My gender pronouns are she, her, hers. I study and teach many things at the University of Utah. Some of those include communication and gender studies. So I think that's the reason why I was chosen to be the moderator. I feel very privileged to be able to moderate this panel, and I also wanted to give or remind everyone that this week we will be addressing sexual violence, and with that, topics that might be triggering and also might be emotionally draining. With that being said, the committee did feel that these are important topics, and so we just want to tell you in advance so that you can do some self-care before, after, or during, whenever you need to do that. There are also gender-neutral restrooms located in the back corner. So if anyone needs to use the restroom, it's right over there. Okay, so I think we'll get started. In recent years, scholars and activists have pointed out society's desensitization to rape. Because sexual violence and rape happen so often and are punished so rarely, we operate under the assumption that rape is an inevitable fact of life. This normalization of rape has led people to internalize beliefs and attitudes that condone and even encourage gendered sexual aggression and violence. Before we get started with the panel, I also wanted to add a couple of grounding ideas. As we move through the panel, I'd like all of us to think about how a person's income, race, gender, sexuality, citizenship, and immigration status would impact their ability to use the criminal justice system as recourse. And hopefully through this panel, we can begin conversations to strategize in ways that address those challenges by moving the most vulnerable from the margin to the center. Let's also not forget that sex and gender are different, and there are more genders than two. People who are gender nonconforming, gender queer, trans, and those and or those who complicate the gender binary experience violence at disproportionate rates. Also, rape is not a women's problem. The highest demographic for sexual assaults are women, but almost all perpetrators happen to be men. In addition to that, rape does happen to men as well. And these assaults go vastly underreported. And so with that, I'm actually going to hand it over to each panelist so that they can introduce themselves. And then once we do that, we'll go ahead and get started with the questions.
I'm going to start. Okay.
Hi. my name is Romeo Jackson. My pronouns are they and them. I am currently a first-year master's student in educational leadership and policy with an emphasis in student affairs and a teaching assistant in gender studies.
My name is Stephanie McGee, and my pronouns are she, hers, and hers. I am a graduate of the political science department and the undergraduate in communication as well. I studied gender, race, and critical studies, and I have worked at the Rape Recovery Center and in community organizing around the stories and the ways that we can center the experiences of marginalized communities who are disproportionately impacted by sexual violence.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay. All right. My name is Dr. Rachel Alicia Griffin. I'm a new faculty member here at the University of Utah in the Department of Communication. Previous to this, I was a tenured faculty member at Southern Illinois University. Particularly, I do a great deal of Black feminist thought, critical race theory, intersectionality, sport, popular culture, and of course, sexual violence research. And I'm probably upwards of about 150 keynotes in anti-sexual violence workshops all over the United States and Canada.
My name is Julie Valentine, and I'm an assistant professor at Brigham Young University College of Nursing. I am also a SANE nurse, sexual assault nurse examiner, or forensic nurse. So victims of sexual violence are my patients. I am a forensic nurse with Wasatch Forensic Nurses, and my research is focused on sexual violence, violence against women, and also violence against all of the vulnerable populations and interpersonal violence.
Okay, so I'll start with the first set of questions, and you all can choose what order you want to go in. Whoever has or wants to share their opinion first can go first. So can you tell us what sexual violence is and what frameworks you and your organization hold around anti-violence work? How does this understanding shape your response services and also your prevention education?
Okay. So I think of sexual violence primarily in two ways often. One, sexual violence as fundamental to the building of the nation, right? So, a big part of colonization in the U.S. was, right, the raping of indigenous women, and then also the raping of enslaved black women, right, to increase the means of production. And then also sexual violence as a means of regulating and criminalizing sexuality, right? And so in this sense, I think of the ways in which, like, there was a recent news report of, like, a father raping his lesbian daughter to prove to her that sex with men is better. And I think when we think of sexual violence in those two ways, what it does is allows us to see that although rape is not normal, it is normal to the nation state, right? And that it is fundamental to how we have come to be here. And then as a relation to that, sexual violence will not end until the process of decolonization is complete. And so what that means, I think, in terms of education and prevention is that we do primary prevention, we educate, right, we provide resources, but also that we must elevate sexual violence to be part of broader social movements, right? That until we remove sexual violence out of this realm of, like, women, right, of, like, women's rights issues or women's issues and lift it up into other places, then sexual violence won't end.
To kind of jump off what Romeo was saying, I want to position this in the second part of the question as far as my work in the community. So when I started at the Rape Recovery Center, I was the only person of color, and I was specifically hired on to make our agency less white and to specifically reflect that in our clients. And I think naively, I kind of went into the position full-heartedly, not realizing that going back to the title of this panel, Rape is Not Normal, I think most agencies in the nonprofit world, rape is not normal when it comes to white women, but it is very much ignored and normalized when it comes to bodies of color, to men of color, to our youth of color. And so a big part of the work that I've been doing and that my department does is to really make that a part. And it's a struggle as far as most nonprofits in the anti-violence world don't really center those experiences. And so when we look at funding, when we look at the programs that exist, that's just really difficult. So to answer your question as far as my positionality, that is my positionality in saying we have to address those things systemically, and we have to center the people of color, indigenous women, and really look at colonization and reflect that back, because I've been doing this for 6 years in our agency, and it's still not reflected in the funding, it's still not reflected in our clients. And when I send these reports of, like, I talk to this many youth of color, the Violence Against Women office, the VOCA office, all of these offices that are funding us don't value that work. And so it's a constant struggle to do that.
I think for myself, there's a few different ways I want to help us map this, going all the way from the global systems level to the nation state, all the way down to the individual. And right out of the gate, I want to advocate that we reframe, for some of us, for many of us, we've been doing this for quite some time, but for some of us it might be new, to reframe sexual violence as an issue of bodily integrity and human rights. Because when we take a social issue and we render it meaningful in the context of every individual's bodily integrity at the micro level, and then human rights at the macro level, we then have a language to narrate it as being far more of a serious issue than perhaps what many of us up here and in this room encounter it being in our everyday lives, right? Because we know that part of the discursive argument we're still having is rape an issue? And for longer than I've been alive, right, people have been saying, of course it's an issue. And yet we're still having this conversation. So as an anti-sexual violence speaker, something I find incredibly, what are my appropriate words, frustrating, is that if you actually look at the keynotes I give as a survivor of color all over this country and Canada, and you go back 50 years, and you go back 100 years, and you go back 150 years, and you go back 200 years, my rhetoric is not that different from women, rhetorically, across centuries. And I always have this moment where I think, well, what does that mean? Yeah. And it means right out of the gate that we're not taking the issue seriously, right? And so when we reframe it as an issue of bodily integrity, we reframe it as an issue of human rights, I think then it becomes an option for governments, for institutions to perhaps take it more seriously. That might be me being optimistic in that moment, because certainly we've done much of that work and it hasn't helped. But then also taking it all the way down to the everyday level, there's a concept that Bob Jensen, he's a professor at the University of Texas, has. It's called sexual intrusion. And what sexual intrusion is the everyday nature of patriarchy and sexism that degrades female intellect and invades female bodies with unsolicited commentary, right? It's the everyday sense of fear that cisgender women, transgender women, and genderqueer and non-binary folks feel moving through the world. So sexual intrusion, you might think of it as what impacts women when they're walking to the car late at night. It's why we pull out our keys and thread them between our fingers and put our purses underneath our backpacks and we walk with our heads up and then we get in our car and we jump into it. Sexual intrusion impacts the everyday way that most women move through the world. And when we think about that as something that's related to rape culture, and we think about that as something that's an issue of bodily integrity and human rights, that gives us a much wider spectrum to start thinking about this issue and advocating for funding that attends to how things like sexual intrusion impact people differently when they move through the world.
A lot of my research is addressing criminal justice system response to sexual assault, but that's really just one piece of how do we make a difference in this issue regarding sexual assault. And when you talked about, you know, the different levels, I feel exactly the same way. It starts with the individual level. And I have that in my work as a forensic nurse. When I'm called in to see a patient, regardless of any background of a victim of sexual assault, it's very important that they release any kind of feeling of self-blame, and that is switching how our entire culture looks at sexual assault. The victims just represent, and survivors represent, what we frequently see is always questioning, so what was the victim doing, rather than us looking at what was the perpetrator doing. So it really, this is an entire switch in our culture. It's not just looking at criminal justice system response. It's not just looking at each individual response. This needs to be a shift in our entire culture and all of us united together. Look at our panel. This is reflective of a mix of many people. We have to all stand up, regardless of where we are, what group we affiliate with. We all have to stand up and say, any kind of sexual violence, we have to take a stand against and say, this is wrong and how do we change it? And it's discussions like this. When I started working in this area and doing research 10 years ago, I honestly felt like I was beating my head against a brick wall. I would beg people to have me come and talk. And now we've seen a greater responsiveness because people know more the numbers now. And they realize this is something that has to be addressed. And I would say everyone is impacted by it. We all are secondary survivors of someone that we know and love that's been impacted by sexual violence, if not survivors ourselves. So it takes all of us.
That was Julie Valentine, an assistant professor at the College of Nursing at Brigham Young University, speaking as part of a forum held a few weeks ago titled, Rape is Not Normal. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them as a public service. And today we are airing a talk recorded a few weeks ago addressing the normalization of rape in our society. It's a problem where people begin to internalize beliefs and attitudes that condone and even encourage gendered sexual aggression and violence. It's a problem that has been identified on Utah College campuses, specifically over the past few years. The panelists who came together to discuss this issue include Rachel Griffin, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Utah, Romeo Jackson, a graduate student in the Education and Leadership and Policy program, Stephanie Maguria, an outreach and access coordinator with the Rape Recovery Center, Julie Valentine, she's an assistant professor in the College of Nursing at Brigham Young University, and the moderator was Flor Olivo, a program coordinator with the Women's Resource Center.
Our next question sort of touches back on the individual. So I'll ask, what are the barriers to transforming our institutions and our movements? And then what can individuals do to address these?
Everything's a barrier. I think one of the barriers that I face most in this work is really with particularly like cis white middle class women work in the movement, right? Particularly around the role of law enforcement when it comes to responses to sexual violence, right? And so like, and if we know that communities of color, queer women, trans women, poor women, immigrant women, right, run down the list of also and women have overwhelming negative experiences with law enforcement and often may be subject to more sexual violence, then it makes little sense, right, to suggest that we should have more law enforcement involved. And right, so one of the key staples of that is the Violence Against Women Act, which does some great stuff, but what it also does is increase funding for law enforcement in the carceral state, right? And so, and this is where, when Kimberly Crenshaw talks about intersectional erasures become super important, right? That if we have a feminist movement that is unattentive to the historical context of race and law enforcement in a country that's advocating for increased law enforcement presence in some way, if we have an anti-racist movement that is unattentive, right, to womanhood and the reality of sexual violence, then what we know is that women of color get lost, right, and may be exposed to more violence. And so how do we move, for me, like transforming looks like moving towards more community-based responses to sexual violence, right, where cops may or may not be called, but that isn't the first action, right? And so on college campuses, that seems to be our default a lot is like, oh, call the cops, right? Like if this happens, call the cops and you'll get the services you need. Well, that's a very privileged mode of thinking about responses to sexual violence. Particularly we think about racialized gendered histories of women of color as promiscuous and loose. And so part of that is how do we get to a place where paradigms align in a way that we can talk about community needs in ways that are better and not isolating. And I think what individuals could do is actually, and this is like 101 to being an advocate, is you ask people what they want and need, right? And so I may have an anti-carceral stance on sexual violence, but if that's what a person wants, right, if they want to file the police report, that's my responsibility to help them make that happen. And oftentimes what happens is that people will push people into reporting crimes because we think the more we know about something existing, then something will happen. But we also, but we know that rape and sexual assault is rampant in the culture and it hasn't necessarily shifted anything. And so those tensions as individuals are things that we've got to work out.
Thank you. I think to jump off of what the panelists had said earlier, specifically speaking to Romeo's previous comments, I think Dr. Griffin had said that, you know, this narrative isn't new. Our voices have been saying kind of the same thing for centuries, right? And I also think when we ask communities to like stand up and stand together, oftentimes what I see is that specifically like white policymakers will say to communities, we want you to stand with us. But then when the communities of color, and I'll speak specifically to my experiences with like immigrant survivors, is that specifically immigrant survivors are saying, your solutions do not work for us. Your solutions, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's applying for U visas or vows, they do not work for us. And then policymakers say, oh, well, okay, we're just gonna kind of keep doing what we're doing. And I very like pointedly right now is that for the last 8 years, we've worked under this Policy of Violence Against Women Act that really said to immigrants, specifically immigrant women, you can stand up and you can get these visas if you report to police, if you do these things. And I'm getting questions daily, well, what is this policy under this new administration? And the reality is that we don't know. Right. And so for me as an advocate to say you should go to law enforcement, you should go to immigration, I'm directly putting my clients into serious danger. And the reality is that I'm then going into these spaces with policymakers and they don't know. And that's fair. Like, we just don't know. But I think it's also a symptom of the inability of policymakers to really listen and to take into account the intersections of like the reality. And it's not new information, it's actually old information that they have refused to listen to, and now it's coming back and being in our face.
Moving in a somewhat different direction, I think, you know, people who love me and people who don't wouldn't describe me as an optimist, but I do genuinely believe in the inside of my soul that if most everyday people understood what, in using one example, what rape feels like, that most people would find a way within themselves to be compassionate, not toward everyone equally, right, in terms of how the intersections of our identities roll out, but I do genuinely believe that one of the greatest barriers to anti-sexual violence, not just activism, but before activism, just consciousness, is a lack of understanding about what rape feels like. And I say that for a specific reason. You know, we have these scripted, empathetic, compassionate cultural narratives in response to many different types of tragedy, right? If somebody's mother dies, we have an empathetic, compassionate cultural response. If somebody is held up at gunpoint in a parking lot, if someone's car is stolen, if someone's room or home is broken into, we have these empathetic, compassionate cultural responses that we reach out to in moments of our own pain and other people's pain. I do not believe that we have gotten to that point yet with acts of sexual violence, particularly with acts of sexual violence toward identity groups that are marginalized by layers and layers and layers of oppression. And so, one of the greatest barriers, I think, is the lack of everyday understanding about what rape feels like and what it does to you and what it does to how you move through the world and what it does to how you encounter people in your life, people that love you, people that don't, strangers you've never met, people that you've seen day in, day out. And so maybe that's optimistic to think that if most everyday people understood what rape feels like, they would respond differently when somebody comes forward and says, somebody hurt me, I need help, right? I think right now we're at a societal point, I thought much more highly of us before Donald Trump was elected. I'll be transparent about that. So I've rolled back in terms of how I feel about our collective consciousness, because I do believe that we elected a sexual perpetrator as president of the United States. And so I'm like, well, maybe we weren't as far as long as I thought we were. So, you know, definitely took a step back there, humbled in a bad way, humbled. But I do still believe in advocating for everyday people to take a moment and learn what rape feels like. Because then I doubt that you would be able to look at survivors of sexual violence in the same dismissive way.
Well, and that the messages we get right now of survivors are so binary in nature, right? So, like, it's all about who deserves our help, right? And often as advocates, we give that to people, right? To write to, like, oh, like, this poor, helpless woman, often white, often middle class, often a mother, right, deserves our protection. And I think that's a block to our empathy, right, is that we have not extended that to racialized and gendered subjects, right, in the same way that that. Right. So I think that empathy, like, that empathy might exist for some women and for some folks contemporarily, but definitely not for a lot of people.
I think it exists, I call it air quotes. Please, radio folks, catch the air quotes, right? when a survivor has been assaulted the right way,
right,
I think we have cultural empathy.
Yes.
And that's when she identifies the right way, which is a white, cisgender, heterosexual, middle to upper class, US American, Western woman. Mm-hmm. So if she has all of that in her favor,
yeah,
in her favor, right? And then she's assaulted by someone she doesn't know, mm-hmm, in a dark space that mirrors our cultural narrative of what right sexual violence looks like. Then, maybe then, but not always, right?
Yep.
Maybe then the door cracks open for normative systemic responses. And that's things like criminal justice, that's things like police, that's things like going to the hospital and being willing to have an exam. And only if a survivor is the right person assaulted in the right way, who's willing to do all of the right things, then we have cultural empathy. I mean, for real.
Yeah.
And I also want to add, when they show up in the right, like, sexuality, like, they're not too promiscuous, they don't.
Right.
And we also know that women of color are read as promiscuous from the very moment they walk into
right.
a room. So that there's already that systemic. And then also when they show up in their trauma reactions in the right way,
mm-hmm,
in a nice way, when they're polite, when they don't yell, when they're not, you know, when they don't fight back to an extent. I mean, we look at the case of the woman who was a domestic violence survivor who shot a gun in there and spent 2 years in prison for that. When I regularly meet with clients in my office who do very similar things, but because they're white women, it's okay.
Romeo and Stephanie, they were discussing what we kind of consider as victim-centered approach, but both brought up a very important point. Whose perspective is that it's victim-centered? We do have a growing body of research about what victim-centered, and for me as a nurse, this means patient-centered approach, putting the victim in control of what happens. This is critically important. I worked for days of my life on House Bill 251, which passed, which allows that campus victim advocates can have confidential communication. There was a opposing bill that would potentially take away the victim rights. That was very worrisome. So we were thrilled that House Bill 251 will pass. But the body of research regarding victims of color, victims of different gender, we do not have very much. And so it goes back to what I really think what Stephanie was talking about is we need to step back a bit and say, do we really understand what a victim-centered approach is for everybody? And that means that we have to listen. And for those of us that are kind of on the front lines of this, I'll tell you that sometimes that's a little bit hard, because you, as a nurse, I want what is best for my patient. And sometimes that may not be what my patient views as best. And I realize that the patient or the victim has to be in control, and we can't look as successful outcomes as being criminal justice system outcomes, and that's the only way we measure success. Because if we do that, that's a losing battle. Because for many people, getting engaged in the criminal justice system after sexual assault will be very damaging to them. And it just goes back to respect and letting that victim be in control. Rape is a crime that takes away somebody's sense of control in every aspect, and everything we do has to go back to saying, what is it that will help them gain that sense of control back?
Thank you. So we've named, or you all have named, some of the barriers facing people that are doing anti-violence work. Could you, I'm going to ask this question and then we're going to open it up for questions, but could you all tell us some of the needs or what you see as the future of anti-violence work? And if you could add to that a little bit of what we can also do for inspiration, because this often becomes a very heavy topic and there can be inspiration in the work. And so if you could sort of name some of those things and then we'll open it up for questions.
I'm thinking that the future sexual violence work has to have an abolitionist view of prisons, and for those of us who that's too much, a dramatically reduced carceral state. And I say that because prisons are breeding grounds for sexual violence, right? Like the idea that, well, one, rapists don't go to jail, right? They just don't, right? But like, let's say like the 2-1, maybe under 1% that do, often get cycled into spaces that are breeding grounds for sexual violence. And so what does this say about a movement that is encouraging the dismantling of sexual violence, then to cycle people into a system where sexual violence is rampant? And so I think like that is what, I think sexual violence has to expand our scope of what sexual violence is. I think about HIV criminalization is state-sanctioned sexual violence, right? Like, there is a criminalization of people with HIV that we just don't articulate as sexual violence. Like, right, that like our frameworks don't allow us to understand that the state has decided that someone has made poor sexual, air quotes, like, that someone has made poor sexual choices, may have contracted HIV/AIDS, and then now we have a right to criminalize these bodies, right? That is sexual violence, right? And I think our frames have not allowed us to be that expansive and to think about it. I'm a pessimist, and so inspiration's not my forte, but I'm not usually the inspiration person. But what I will say is that I think there's always potential to do better. And I think for me, that looks like, how am I pushing and expanding my own thinking and frameworks around the work? And that for me is inspiring in terms of understanding that one, I don't have to know everything, I'll never know everything, and that there are better ways for us to do the work. And I think that there's always a better way to do it, to me, offers some sense of inspiration towards a better future. And also, just because I'm a pessimist, I have to add, and that we really, really have to end systems of domination, or sexual violence will never end. And that's the opposite of me being like, I don't know when that's gonna happen, because as critical race theory tells us, racism is prevalent and permanent. And so those are balancing.
I'm also a pessimist. So you asked the wrong question. But I think most of the work that I do now is working with youth in primary prevention. And when we look at the numbers of who is assaulted, we know that 80% of individuals who are assaulted will be assaulted before the age of 18. That's just the reality. And so I really do think the future of this work has to be with our youth, has to be younger, has to include comprehensive sexual education, both positive, like sex ed, and also the negative of what are the repercussions when that doesn't happen, or children are seeing that in their home. And I think also, just from a really personal level, I'm a mother to a young boy, a boy of color, and I feel like that's where the only place I feel like I have hope and inspiration, sadly sometimes because I am a pessimist, is in talking to these young boys, little boys, and they get it, right? When I started doing this work 6 years ago, I'd go into high schools and junior highs, and I had to explain, like, what is sexual violence? What is rape culture? And sometimes I would get huge pushback. I go into schools now, and the first thing they ask me when I open up to questions is like, so are you talking about rape culture? And they bring out like these memes and like these things that they know. And so I have to say the work has to be, one, nonviolent. It has to incorporate youth of color, specifically boys of color, and we have to start talking to our youth and taking into consideration trauma, just intergenerational trauma. They're seeing trauma in their homes, then they're going into these systems and getting kicked out, being re-traumatized, and it's all happening before they're 18, before they even get to this audience. And there's no way that we're addressing that right now.
Well, I think one of the greatest points of access that gives me hope, it's actually quite similar in that, you know, for the most part, I'm brought into colleges and universities to give keynotes, and one of the things that I always advocate for is get me into a high school, get me into a junior high school. You know, I can take out the profanity that's laced throughout if that's what needs to happen. You know, but here's why I say that explicitly and specifically, and it's because by the time students get to college, and one, we have to remember that less than 30% of the U.S. American population accesses, right, four-year degrees. And so if we're trying to generate this kind of systemic change through higher education, then we've got to be honest right there and say, yeah, we're hitting about maybe 30% of the U.S. American population if we're lucky. And so if we actually go into educational spaces pre-college, then we have more of a likelihood at being able to catch not only problematic behavior to take a punitive lens, but also just the process of socialization that we all endure as we grow up. And so here's the other part where I am strangely, perhaps, optimistic. You know, I've spoken enough and I've had enough contact with everyday people that I get folks who come up to me at the end of a keynote, and to me they look like cisgender males, and they tell me stories about a friend of a friend and do I think, right? And in that moment, they oftentimes they are mortified and they have tears in their eyes and they are nervous. They are looking at the ground, they are looking at the ceiling, they are looking anywhere but at me. And in that moment, I get this feeling on my inside, is it okay, like, this person in front of me has a question about whether or not they hurt someone. Like, they're wondering if they committed this act of rape that I just described. And they're sorry. And they're scared. And if you think about the men, the few cisgender men who are held accountable for acts of violence, they do look sorry, and they do look scared, and they do look regretful. Now, to be fair, maybe they look that way because there's cameras all up in their face, and their family's been trotted out, and the rare instance that there is legal accountability. But generally speaking, I think most people who hurt people, if they knew they could make a different choice, they might make a different choice. But I don't think that a lot of men, those socialized into manhood, whether it's trans men, genderqueer men, cis men, I don't think that most realize that the behavior they've learned is violent until they've already done the damage, right? And then they ascend into positions of power, you know, like let's say the presidency. And then what they do is they infiltrate our everyday thinking that they get to set the standard for what manhood looks like. And I think if we interrupt that younger, that is a point of hope for me. But I don't want us to forget something, and that is that every survivor who feels less alone, to me, that is success. I do not define success systemically because I'd probably quit every facet of my everyday life possible, right? Yeah. But every single survivor that feels like people showed up because we give a shit about sexual violence, then I feel good about that one survivor who feels like people showed up and they care, right? That means a lot to me. And so I don't view that as a low bar. I view that as a very compassionate, humanistic bar.
Well, I'm a huge optimist, so.
Thank goodness.
And I'm thrilled that we're having so many discussions about this topic, and that makes me have more optimism. Some look at trying to shift this culture regarding sexual assault, similar to how we had a cultural shift regarding drunk driving. I remember when I was really a little girl that there would be jokes about, oh yeah, he was drinking and he got in the car and was driving, and there really wasn't much accountability. It was in some ways, and I think most of you are younger to remember this, but in some ways it was just joked about, I'm like, oh, that just happens. But think now, it's not. That's looked down upon. There are stiff penalties. There's really a social non-acceptance of drunk driving. Some feel that we can have that same shift towards sexual assault, towards locker room talk. And I think there is a move towards that. But as we've all talked about, it starts when children are young. It starts teaching them about bodily autonomy. If you have a three-year-old and you say, go give grandma a kiss goodbye, and the three-year-old's like, I don't want to give grandma a kiss. The parent says, great, just wave goodbye. You know, it's letting them have bodily autonomy and teaching that in our homes with our children, teaching our children about bodily autonomy, teaching them about consent, then expanding to teaching our whole culture how to respond to sexual assault. I'm a huge believer in the End Violence Against Women Start by Believing program, which is supportive when somebody reports sexual assault. Does away with the victim blaming. I frequently tell people, never ask why questions, because as soon as you ask a why question, it immediately puts somebody on the defensive. If I were to say to somebody, so why did you wear that shirt today? You immediately feel uncomfortable. Well, isn't this an okay shirt? Well, if we ask anybody that reports to us a sexual assault a why question, then we immediately compound any kind of self-blame or that they might be feeling, and they frequently will not reach out. So there's so, I mean, this is just like this giant puzzle, but I think I'm gonna be the optimist, and I think we really are trying to pull these different pieces of this puzzle to make the whole picture better. I'll go back again that I'm a nurse. So for me, this is making our whole society healthier, safer, and that takes all of us working together.
Can I add one more quick thing?
Yes.
I also think like one of the things that we have to do is begin to talk about sexual violence prevention and education outside of binaries or like unrealistic scenarios. Like I used to be a part of this peer theater troupe that did like sexual violence trainings with people. And like there'd be these scenarios where people would be, where like we would be like, oh, okay. So like you're at a party and because you're counting your drink after you've had two, you can no longer consent. And it becomes a real question around like how conducive is that to a real life scenario, right? And so in questions around what does what does consent look like at a packed club when you're drunk, right? Like actually in that sense, no one has, what's body autonomy? What's the choice to be touched, right? I was at a club Friday. I was running into all kinds of people, right? Like, and so there are these ways that I think we need to then fit our conversations into what students, if we're thinking of higher education, are actually doing and experiencing in their lives. So it's not distant, right? So it's not a metaphor. So it's not an abstract thought. Because often at times as I was delivering these presentations, it felt like an abstract exercise. And any conversations from students, men or women really, around like what if this scenario got shut down as contributing to rape culture, which sure, people's intentions, we never know and it could be, but there's also a conversation about realities that we navigate.
Sorry, and I'll let you get tech questions, but one thing that I've started doing that I think has been really powerful, kind of going to back to like we have to stop talking about theory and hypotheticals, is instead of asking students what is consent, because everybody knows no means no now. Some students will say yes means yes, right? They'll move to that positive. But I started asking, and I think going back to what you were saying earlier, like how did you learn to give consent? How do you get consent?
Yes.
And when I ask often, because they'll be really quiet, but when I say, how do you get consent? One, they get really awkward because they think I'm trying to talk about sex. I'm not. I'm really trying to just get you to think that all of us are socialized to not get consent or to get consent in kind of like shady ways because we're too shy or we're at the club and we all know that game, right? And so just a kind of like a question and thought, like go home and ask your partner, ask your kids, ask your parents, how do you get consent? How do you talk about consent? And how are we teaching our youth to do that?
And I think we also have to talk about the nonverbal.
Yep.
There's a huge nonverbal component to consent. And we need to discuss that and say, how do you ascertain somebody's nonverbal? And are you aware of the nonverbal? And that has to be part of it as well.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're bringing you a forum recorded recently titled Rape is Not Normal. It was presented by the Office for Equity and Diversity at the University of Utah. The panelists include Rachel Griffin, an assistant professor of communication, Romeo Jackson, a graduate student in the Education and Leadership and Policy program, Stephanie Merguria, an outreach and access coordinator with the Rape Recovery Center, Julie Valentine, she's an assistant professor in the College of Nursing at Brigham Young University, and Flor Olivo served as the moderator. She's a program coordinator with the Women's Resource Center.
Before we ask questions, I did have just two things to remind you. So when you're asking a question, please remember to contribute to the safety within the group, the empowerment within yourself and others, and also the way that you're respecting the conversation overall.
Hi, I'm James Hernandez. I'm a second-year master's student in Education, Culture, and Society in the School of Education. Y'all mentioned a lot about like education for victims, and also you mentioned the criminal justice. Actually, all of y'all mentioned the criminal justice system, who it affects, who it is really made for, or who it's a safety net for sometimes. Mm-hmm. But then you also you switched to mentioning boys of color, educating them, and I'm not surprised at the panel. I kind of expect it's usual, like, guys got the right amount of color, got the right amount of gender. But I'm not surprised that there's not a white man on the panel. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious of what are we doing to inform the white boys mm-hmm. that grow up to come to the Hinckley Institute that then go to the Capitol? Because that's what I'm kind of curious about is because the conversation tends to stop at a certain level, like we've noticed for 200 years, y'all had mentioned back. What happens to the boys that do get away, where the criminal justice system does not hold them accountable? What are ways that y'all think that we can do on an individual level, but all the way up to changing laws eventually, in the state of Utah at least?
Okay. Does one of y'all want to take that on?
Yeah, part of what I think through boys and men of color is because those are the communities that I care about. In part, right, so like I care about women, queer, and trans people of color. And within every racial group, right, the dynamics of violence is gonna be interracial, right? So black on black crime is a myth, fun fact, right? And every racial group is because of segregation and how we're grouped together, right, through like all kinds of laws and policies. And so there's a way that boys and men of color are not being incarcerated because of sexual violence, right? So I think like we can't suggest that boys and men of color are getting arrested because of that. It's usually right hyped up drug offenses and or other and they're like minor crimes. And so that's why I typically focus there because that's what I care about. And also that's how for me like we will end sexual violence in black communities, right? Is that we need to reconstruct what black manhood and black masculinity looks like. And so, like, whiteness will be whiteness. I don't have the imagery. Like, but what I can impact is my brothers, who frankly are, who say, like, really, really, right, like, anti-woman, things that contribute to rape culture. Those are the black boys that I have, the black men I have access to. And so that's where my focus lies there.
So there's a great organization in Utah called MAN, Men's Anti-Violence Network. I'd encourage many of you to look into this organization. Really doing what you're talking about. This is not, and as it was discussed here, sometimes I'm asked to give talks to women's groups, and I always go back, this is not a women's issue. So I'm happy to talk to a diverse group, but to pigeonhole this as a women's issue, it's not. This is a society issue. So that's one organization that I'd encourage you to look into. And you can just Google it. It's MAN Utah. But it goes back again to just this overall, let's take our society and shift how we think about sexual violence. Goes back to the Start by Believing program, the other things we've talked about, and that's not just for individual cultures or groups, that needs to be for all of us, right? Everyone.
Is it James?
Yes.
James, I'm gonna push back a little bit.
Yeah.
I actually think that In the context of the United States, most of our colleges and universities, they are traditionally white and or predominantly white, right? Now, we know that demographically the scales, and we don't yet measure for gender diversity because we're, you know, transphobic and genderqueerphobic like that. But we know that, on college campuses, some at the undergrad level, not at the graduate level, not at the faculty level, not at the staff, certainly not at the administrative level and the executive level, we know that the scales have tipped and we have more women earning undergraduate degrees on most campuses than males, right? Mm-hmm. But here's where I'm pushing back, because from my experiences, when we have campus groups dedicated to anti-violence, whether it's, you know, men against rape on campus or men against violence, whatever the campus constituency is, most of those groups are predominantly white males because most of the students that they're drawing from are predominantly white, right? And so one of the arguments that taps right into what we've said is that we actually have to start doing more intersectional work because most acts of sexual violence are intra-racial, meaning white people are hurting white people, black people are hurting black people, you know, biracial black and white person is being hurt by another person of color. So because most acts of sexual violence happen within race opposed to between races, although that's not the case in all circumstances, if we're not educating men and boys of color, then it's having a negative impact on women of color. It's right, if we're not, so do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I actually think that one of the reasons we've seen more white women who are willing and able to come forward through the formal trajectories that we have, like hospitals, police, and law, is because most of the anti-violence education, tapping back into the comment earlier about funding, is funded, and that funding reaches traditionally and predominantly white groups. Right? So that's one of the reasons I think you'll find many advocates of color who are focused in communities of color, because the federal funding isn't necessarily reaching the groups of young males that we would advocate need to be included.
And I would say that, like, just in my agency, that is clear, like, what we're showing. When we look at the services, like direct services, 90% of our clients are white women. When we look at prevention, 90% of the people I talk to are actually white men and white boys. And so I think that's one of the reasons why, also, just like, one, because it's the community I care about, but because I also see a lack on the daily of who's being reached and who's accessing the services.
Right, but correct me if I can't speak for all of us. I don't think anyone up here wants less white cisgender men or women to come forward. It's not about having less of some groups come forward. It's about opening up the space so that we can have a constellation of identity groups, positionalities, political underpinnings come forward. So it's not like, I want less, you know, white cisgender heterosexual women to come. Absolutely not. I want all the white cisgender heterosexual women that can come forward to come forward. Right, but I also want us to expand the space so that more people can come forward and report and ask for the help they need and deserve.
And there's a history that needs to be attended to in the ways in which whiteness, and particularly white women, have used racialized tropes of men of color as sexual predators. That needs to be attended to in ways that I just can't do with white women or white people in spaces, because there's nuance and depth that, like, I can't convey right there. So there's ways that we have a both and history that men of color are the ones enacting violence on women of color, communities of color, and also particularly black masculinity has been constructed as inherently violent against white womanhood and white fragility. And so like, that talk for me, I need to have with other people of color, right? Like, that talk to me is so nuanced and layered that, like, right? Because, like, white women see a black man walking down the street and get freaked out, and it's like, well, there's some racist things coming up for you there, right? You actually might be afraid because of gender dynamics. And there's these both ands, right, that we have an inability to engage simultaneously, right? That for this white woman, like, her racism might be showing up in white supremacy and a very real threat of violence as a woman, right? And so, like, what do you do with that, right? Like, so that's a conversation that we need to have that we don't, right? Because men of color may call her racist. White women are like, she's a woman. I dare you say race is a part of it. And neither one of those things are reality in that moment, most likely.
So we have time for one more question.
Hi. My name is Sam Stamos. This is just a quick question for the BYU nurse. I was just wondering, how common is sexual assault on the BYU campus, you know, compared to other Utah campuses?
Right now, we don't know. Campus climate surveys are traditionally what universities have used. The University of Utah had one recently to get those numbers. that's the next step that BYU campus will be doing. So we will know those numbers. And as a researcher, a lot of my work is focused on finding out the numbers, because without the numbers, we can't measure, are we making any kind of improvement? I did a study looking at Salt Lake County in 2013, looking at criminal case outcomes. And these were cases where all the victims said that they wanted to prosecute, had full rape kits collected, and only 6% were prosecuted. I'm repeating that study next year, because then we can say, all right, here we were, we've made some changes, are we seeing any difference? I see great value in knowing the numbers. So that's very important information to know, and I think we will know that soon, but it really is through campus climate surveys. And campus climate surveys not only giving you the numbers of how many experience any form of sexual misconduct is the university term for it, but also it helps to measure social norms, which is also critically important. And we'll find out.
Thank you. So if we could give our panelists a big thank you by clapping for them.
This forum, titled Rape is Not Normal, was presented by the Office for Equity and Diversity at the University of Utah and recorded back on March 6th. If you'd like to hear this full conversation, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org, or in the podcast version of this show. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.